Welcome to the Learning Scientist Podcast, a podcast for teachers, students, and parents about evidence-based practice and learning.
Welcome back to the Learning Scientist Podcast. I am so excited to be joined today by Dr. Rob Malkin, who's going to talk to us a lot about the work that he has done in sort of championing educational opportunities for students that are really impressive and cool. So Bob, why don't we just get started with, tell us like your official titles.
So I'm a professor of the practice of biomedical engineering and global health emeritus at Duke University. I'm also the academic director and founder of the International Research Institute of North Carolina. And since you mentioned the experiential learning opportunities for students, I'm also the founder of the Global Public Service Academies and Engineering World Health.
Holy cow, that's so many things. Your background and your story for how you got here is just so fascinating to me. And I love for people to hear about sort of the winding trajectories of people's careers. So can you just share with the listeners kind of how you got to this point, your story?
Yeah, so I went to University of Michigan as an undergraduate in electrical engineering and discovered a passion for biomedical engineering when a faculty member approached a class basically and said, anybody interested in research? And at the time I was washing dishes at the law school. And so if she wanted me to wash her test tubes, it sounded better than washing dishes. But in fact, she wanted me to be involved in research. And I became passionate about biomedical engineering at that point, even though the field itself really didn't exist. I worked as an engineer designing pacemakers, heart-lung machines, a little bit of defibrillators, and also lived in Thailand for a while, teaching English as a foreign language, completely different activity. Before going back to graduate school at Duke, got a PhD there, and then I've been a professor teaching I taught at City College of New York, at CUNY, at Columbia. I had a lab at Columbia University, also in New York, University of Tennessee, University of Memphis, and now at Duke University.
Yeah, so I read a write-up, and maybe I'll include it in the show notes, about some interesting experiences that happened when you were in Thailand that really kind of like spurred your kind of passion for coming back into biomedical engineering. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, one of the most probably moving experiences in my life, in fact, happened in Thailand. I was my job was to work on human trafficking, the prevention of human trafficking, of course. It was illegal. It's clearly immoral. But it was very difficult, and in fact remains very difficult today, to eliminate. So what we were doing is going into villages, very remote villages. So we would hike for sometimes an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours into a village, and try to educate the young, mostly girls. The idea being that if they could become more valuable staying in the community, then they wouldn't be trafficked. My job was to teach English as a foreign language, so I would teach them things like how to sew Thailand on a shirt so they could go sell shirts in the marketplace, or the more advanced ones, how to negotiate, because then if they can negotiate in English, they would be very valuable to the families. But one of my colleagues was with us on a trip to a village where they were making shirts, blue shirts, a very particular cut of shirt. And, you know, I did my thing, and he came in and did his thing. And what he taught them was a different way to dye the shirts by controlling the temperature of the dye vats. This is like a fact you could Google now in 2 seconds. Back then, there was no internet, there was no Google, there was no cell phones, probably still no cell phones where we were. But he knew this one fact. But overnight, that village stopped trafficking all of its children because they were more valuable on the dye vats than they were as basically most of it was sex trade workers. And so, you know, that really taught me the impact that you can have. Just a single fact, like I said, a Googleable fact, saved hundreds and hundreds of girls from a terrible life. And it was very moving for me and impacted the rest of my career, actually.
It's really incredible. And I can see, looking at sort of your career trajectory, some of that, right? That impact of trying to reach out to the global community and have an impact worldwide. Can you talk a little bit, you know, you talked about some of your nonprofits. Can you talk a little bit about some of these experiential opportunities that you have created for for students? And maybe kind of we can start with the global health stuff and then move into talking a bit about some of the stuff you have for high school students too.
Yeah, sure. So one of the first programs I set up was Engineering World Health. And we started working in 1993, but finally incorporated in 2001 and started taking students in the program in 2001. And this was almost directly inspired by the work in Thailand, because the man who had that big impact, he did not need to have 20 years of graduate study. He did not need to have a medical degree. He just knew one fact, and he applied the right fact at the right time and made a huge impact. So I was convinced that others could do this as well if we could organize the training so that it would have the right facts on the right locations and at the right time. Everyone who was interested could make that kind of impact. Engineering World Health was formed around that. So college students take about a month to train, usually in the local language, which is one of the biggest barriers, is in fact language and communication, as well as technical aspects of medical equipment. And then they work a second month in local hospitals, usually repairing medical equipment, most of it repairing donations from other people that never worked. So most of it is repairing other people's donations. And they have had a huge impact, doubling the number of surgeries sometimes in hospitals, opening up ability to have a C-section, for example, that was never possible before in a hospital, and much, much more. So Engineering World Health has had a huge impact. I'm no longer the director. I'm still the founder, but no longer the director. It continues today, more than 20 years later. I'm still working, still having a huge impact on both the students as well as the hospitals that they serve. And then Global Public Service Academies, another public health one, was focused a little bit more clinically. So for students who aren't really interested in medical equipment, but still want to make a difference, in that program, we do, in fact, take high school students, but as well older students. And they learn some very basic skills, like how to take blood glucose, how to give somebody's visual acuity tests, take blood pressure, some other simple measurements, help the people decide whether they need to go further and see the clinic. A lot of the villages that we're working in, clinics can be 4 or 5 hours walk away. And so the population is hesitant to go to the clinic when, you know, they're not really sure whether they have a problem. There could be a long wait, could be money involved. And so an extra level of screening can really help those patients. And we also do provide some direct assistance in reading glasses and some other smaller implementation. But most of it is education in the very remote villages. These are some great programs. I'm also not the director of GPSA anymore, but it also continues. It's also still a great program with trips all over the world. And these trips are transformative. They're absolutely transformative for the students as well as for the communities that they're working in.
One thing that I noticed in looking into these is that there is obviously a financial stake here, right? In order to get to these places, in order to participate in these programs. And so I'm always kind of interested in just making sure that there are nice, equitable opportunities for students. So if people are interested in what you're talking about right now, is there financing available for folks?
Yeah, it's a great question. So that is absolutely true. All of these programs require tuition to participate in the programs. The staff is paid, the community is paid, and the community often benefits, in fact, from that money because we're paying for food and housing, lodging, transportation. In other words, hiring local community members. So we're helping the local economy. And that all requires money. But we certainly do understand that there's folks who can't afford these activities, at least in IRI, another activity that's a hands-on research activity. More than 50% of the students, in fact, are on financial aid. So we have students in IRI paying as little as $5, $10, and students who are paying thousands of dollars participate in the program. It's a lot like college. There are financial aid opportunities. You have to work to find them, but there are opportunities.
So you mentioned IRI. I don't think we've talked about that yet. Can you share a little bit, what does IRI stand for? And what exactly is that program? And even how did it get started? Because I reading about it, I'm just like fascinated that you have enough faculty interested in making this happen.
Yeah, it's a great question. So IRI is the International Research Institute of North Carolina. And it is a program that matches up high school students with faculty who are interested in doing research. And I would love to say that it was a carefully planned carefully executed. But in fact, it was a move of desperation. When the pandemic hit, we were no longer able to work with the students that we already had been working with. So I've had high school students in my lab for 25 years. So, you know, Duke was having problems even having me on campus and figuring out undergraduates on campus. It was all very confusing during the pandemic. So we started IRI originally simply to facilitate the relationships we already had with high school students. Then we discovered there are thousands of students all over the country, tens of thousands all over the world, that never had access to great labs. So they're interested in doing research, but they couldn't find labs. Likewise, there are faculty who really want to work with high school students because they're passionate about research, they're passionate about their topic, they feel that the concept of research and what is a fact is under threat, but they don't want to bother with recruiting, vetting, figuring out all the legal paperwork, insurance, and whatever. So IRI has continued, even though Duke's pretty much back to normal. But we've continued IRI as a way to match up these students with the faculty.
That's just so fantastic and something certainly I don't think was available to me, or if it was, I didn't know about it. So I'm excited that we're kind of getting the word out that there are these opportunities. So those are for high school students of what age group? Like, does it start as young as freshmen in high school could do it?
Absolutely. So we start with freshmen in high school and go all the way up, in fact, into college. There are students who are in college and still can't find a lab that they want to work at because perhaps they went to a liberal arts college and they decided to go into sciences, or perhaps the faculty are just busy with their graduate students and they won't take undergraduates. So absolutely, we have a wide range of students. You know, a lot of the work is a challenge for the younger students, the freshman, sophomore, and it's challenging. They need to be very professional, very mature, but we mentor them. They'll be helped with graduate student. U.S. faculty will help them as well, and they'll take them through every step of the process, from beginning to publication.
I mean, really, really a fantastic program. So, I mean, gosh, you haven't done much. you are a very busy person.
I'm a busy person. It's true.
What is next on the horizon? What's next on the horizon for you? What is the current project?
Yeah, so IRI is definitely where we're focusing the attention on. It's growing very, very quickly. As you may know, many universities have been vacillating, but recently have dropped standardized tests, part of admissions. And this has left a lot of parents and students confused and unsure what to do. And somehow they feel research is part of a portfolio that will help them get admissions. Unfortunately, there are a lot of organizations that are offering really expensive, not very good programs. So I got together with a colleague of mine. We are just publishing a book on a guide to academic research for high school students. That's going to come out next week, actually. And, you know, that's really where I want to focus attention next, is really getting the word out to high school students. If you want to do research, it's great. It's a wonderful activity. I love it. I love it with a passion. And you may as well, but be careful. There are things that can go wrong, and you want to be looking out for these things. You want to protect, of course, your wallet, but you also want to protect your time and ultimately your college application and beyond. As you probably know, the president of Harvard University just lost her job partially because she didn't cite something correctly that she published as a student. So, you know, research can be very powerful, but if you make a mistake, it can haunt you for the rest of your career. So I really want to start getting the word out to high school students about research and about how to be careful when they're doing research.
I think that's so incredibly important, especially because, you know, I feel like a lot of high school students who may need that research experience now to get into college are sort of what I'll call first generation researchers, right? Their parents weren't doing research in order to be able to guide them and tell them these things. And, you know, the academia is a whole like field in and of itself of like weird rules that you don't necessarily know about unless you have someone to guide you through that. So I love the idea of providing that for students. And we'll include a link to that book in the show notes as well so that folks can access it if they are interested.
Awesome.
You know, Bob, you have had such an incredible career. You've done so many different things. And really, I mean, it has to be an amazing thing to know, to be able to see the global impact of your work. I'm wondering what kind of advice you might give to either students or educators. Most of the people listening right now are really going to be educators. And what advice would you give them if they, you know, are inspired by you, by your story, by the work that you've done, and either want to get involved or want to be able to have a similar impact? What advice would you give folks?
Yeah, so the first piece of advice I would give both, actually, for the high school students or young students is befriend your faculty, your high school biology teacher, physics teacher, chemistry teacher. These people are working really, really hard because they love the field and they love working with you. And they can be a resource for the rest of your career. So I am still in contact with students that I taught more than 20 years ago, more than 30 years ago. And I'm still in contact with them and I'm still helping them find jobs, make career decisions, make connections. Networking is super important in science and other fields as well. So for the high school students, the young students, really take advantage of what you have now. You're surrounded by faculty who deeply care about you and their field. Make connections with them and keep those connections. For the educator, you know, my recommendation is work at renewing those connections with your students. Of course, when they're in the classroom in front of you, it's not a problem. You see them every day, you see them every other day, whatever. But the year later, you know, that's when it really starts to fade, or 2 years later. So I make a real effort 1 year, 2 years after I've had a student that I really think had potential, that I really enjoyed teaching, to reach out to them and have a feedback session with them, have a coffee with them, just trying to rekindle those connections. And that has paid dividends, you know, both for my soul, if you will, as well as friendships and connections with students that, again, have lasted my lifetime. So I really would encourage people to form these connections and benefit from them rest of your life.
I think that's amazing. I can say that about my own, you know, educator journey too, that some of the biggest impacts that I think I have had on the world weren't directly through me. They were through my students and sort of some of the opportunities that I gave them to develop into the incredible humans that are going out into the world and making change. But sticking with them and being able to help them in their career trajectory has been amazing. So thank you so much for that. Do you have any parting words for our listeners? Anything else that you wanted to share today that you haven't had a chance to?
No, you've done a great job. Thank you for all those great questions. And as you mentioned, I would encourage people to check out the show notes. I'll try to make sure to give you the links that you need to be helpful there.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today, Bob. And yeah, keep on changing the world. Thank you for all your good work.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
This episode is funded by listeners like you. To support our work and gain access to exclusive content, visit our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/learningscientists.